The next case is In Re Estate of Chess. Counsel may approach, and appellant's counsel can go ahead and approach the podium, and that's Mr. Whitmore.
Good morning, Chief Judge, Your Honors, and counsel. I'm Tom Whitmore. I'm here on behalf of Richard Chess, who is the appellant. Mr. Chess was removed as personal representative of the estate of his father, Calvin Chess, and he was subjected to a significant surcharge as a result of his actions in managing the estate. I'd like to start with the idea that the complaints of Mr. Chess's management of the estate had nothing to do with wrongful behavior, had nothing to do with breach of trust or other breach of fiduciary duty. The complaint was, in all cases, about decisions that he made as personal representative.
What was his background? What had he done? Or what was his training? What was his job?
I don't really know what his job was, but he had no special training as an accountant or
financial
attorney or financial or any of those things. He's just a guy, I guess.
A son of the deceased.
Yes. And Calvin Chess died intestate. He had four heirs. Three adult children and one grandchild. And the contestants here were Richard and his half-sister, Christine. And under the probate code, the personal representative is enjoined to exercise and act according to the best interests of the estate and its beneficiaries, exercising reasonable judgment. The criticisms involved the amount of rent that was charged on certain state property that was leased during the time of the probate administration. Christine had asserted that those rents should have been at fair market rent, and our position is that the personal representative is simply enjoined to be reasonable in making decisions. The probate court gives him the right and the power to enter into leases, and doesn't provide any direction as to how his decision is to be made, other than to act in the best interest, make reasonable decisions in the best interest of the estate. So,
well, let's talk about the rental properties a little bit. First of all, was there any type of, during the lifetime of Calvin Chess, was there any type of written leases?
No, they were I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
They were oral leases. The main house, Calvin's home where he lived, he had two grandsons living with him.
He was living in one of these homes at
yes.
the time. And he had two grandsons there.
Grandsons living with him.
So there was probably no oral lease at that time either.
Other than the allowance of them to live there.
Okay.
And that was rent free.
All right. And as to the other home?
The other house is much smaller, and it was occupied during Calvin's lifetime by a handyman who he had made the deal with to live on the property and perform maintenance around the property. And the reason for that was that there were city code violations that needed to be cured. Calvin was concerned that the city would condemn the property And so he engaged this fellow to perform repairs on the property.
And then did Richard, and Richard continued with that arrangement?
He did.
All right. What evidence was presented that the value of the of those residences was actually being improved by this handyman?
His testimony, I believe his name was Scott, was he provided actually a list of things that he had done during his occupancy there, both before and after Calvin's death. And the amount that of work that he did after Calvin's death was more than sufficient in terms of dollars, as he and Richard had agreed to cover the amount of rent that that property would have borne in cash.
But did it actually improve the value of the houses?
Well, to the extent that the city code violations were eventually removed, yes. There are no before and after appraisals, and there weren't improvements of the sort where, like, putting in a new fireplace or a swimming pool or something like that would add to the value. So they were maintenance issues mainly.
As far as the CenturyLink stock, what, there was 11,000 some odd shares of that, is that correct?
Yes.
Did the decedent, had the decedent worked at CenturyLink? Was there some connection between him and that stock other than just an investment?
Not that I know of, Your Honor.
So what was, apparently it took 5 months to get your client appointed. And in that 5 month period, that's, the stock had gone from 20 some odd dollars down to 16 or 15, $5 loss in share price, is that correct?
It did, and the reason for that was that CenturyLink had cut their dividend in the month of December, a month before my client was appointed, and that had an immediate effect on their stock price. And then subsequent to that, the stock just declined perhaps another $5 over the course of administration.
But were dividends still being paid during that time?
Significant dividends. I think there were $27,000, I believe, of dividends that were paid during that time.
Was there evidence of the stock price per share price at the time of the hearing?
It was not admitted. The trial court did not admit it. It was.
Well, wasn't there some documents with regard to that stock price that was admitted as part of an affidavit that was submitted?
That's
at the second trial.
That's correct.
The second hearing, hearing on the surcharge.
Yes, at the hearing on the removal, that evidence was not permitted. But at the hearing on the surcharge, the court allowed in two significant affidavits, and I believe in ours, the stock price was noted.
How much farther had it fallen from the $15 to $16 level?
I hesitate to say. I don't recall specifically.
Is it your position that whatever was going on with the stock, it was simply market volatility as opposed to anything else?
That's true. And there may have been things in this company's management that caused it to decline, but I believe it was mainly market forces. And the significance of the CenturyLink stock is that the probate court actually directs that if, to the extent practicable, the personal representative is enjoined to distribute assets in kind. The statute says shall distribute them in kind. And in the power section, I believe it is, of the probate code, it states that the personal representative is entitled to retain assets in the estate for distribution in kind, regardless of whether they are appropriate for a trust. So the court's decision that required diversification just doesn't apply. It should not have been applied to this case.
Now, had he wanted to, if he had agreed with the other beneficiaries, the stock could have been sold and reinvested into something else pending final distribution, correct?
It could have, and the normal process in the states that I have dealt with is that the personal representative will simply deposit any cash resulting from things such as assets have been sold into a checking account that would not bear any interest. I mean, that's typical because it needs to be immediately available for distribution at the conclusion. And so it would be very surprising for a personal representative to play the market with cash that he realized as a result of selling estate assets.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Whitmore. Was there any other questions? All right. Thank you, Mr. Whitmore. And is it Ms. Ryan who's arguing for the appellate?
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Julie Ryan on behalf of the appellee / the successor personal representative, Christine Spaniers. What this court needs to keep in mind is that this was should have been a simple estate matter, but it was subjected to multiple 90-day delays and misadministration and dissipation of assets at the hands of Richard Chess when he was the personal representative. This is a case that it did take some time for Richard to be appointed as a personal representative. The decedent did die on October 30th of 2018.
And is he responsible for any losses to the value of the estate during the period of time from the date of death till the date of his appointment?
Yes, and that's really where the surcharge is coming from. So we have one of the big issues is the failure to collect rent. There were two estate real estate properties in the estate, and as we heard a little bit, there were non-heirs living in both of those properties for much of the time that Richard was the personal representative of the estate. It was over a year. I believe it was about 25 months.
Well, wait a minute. My question is though he died at the end of October, and then the personal representative was appointed in, I believe, the end of January.
Yes.
So we have 3 months, basically, of a gap. Is he responsible for those losses during that 3 months? He wasn't personal representative during those time.
Right.
That time.
We presented evidence to encompass that period of time as well. For example, for the rent, saying that you should have collected the back rent from the non-heir tenants for those periods. But alternatively, we did say, district court judge, if you're not willing to accept that, you know, there is this whole other period over a year that you still didn't collect rent, and you were appointed at that point, and you should have collected that.
Ms. Ryan, are you able to tell me or tell the court how the county court arrived at the figure of the surcharge that it awarded?
I can say that no, I cannot, I can't do it with certainty. What I can tell this court is that within our Exhibit 16 that we offered at the hearing on the surcharge, we had created a demonstrative chart, really, and it's page 149 from Exhibit 16. And the chart is based on direct evidence or testimony documents. It's all included in Exhibit 16. It's showing the amount of rents that should have been collected. The number in this chart, just for your information, it is based on a scenario of had you had collected it right as of the date of the death of the decedent. However, we had testimony during the hearing for that alternative argument. So, you know, that might have been a situation where the court was thinking, well, he wasn't appointed yet. I'm going to do some adjustments there. As well as the stock, we had based that upon, I think you had asked Richard's counsel earlier about whether there was evidence on that. That's also within our Exhibit 16. We had the history of the closing amounts for the CenturyLink stock, as well as the S&P 500 for all the times that we used for our calculation we provided.
But that exhibit has gaps in it, it has the starting point, I believe, if I recall it correctly, it has the starting point of about the time of death, and it has, and then it's up to date, but it doesn't have the entire period in between. Is that correct?
Yes, I believe that's correct. And the reason
so we
for
can't
that
know how much dividends were paid
during
that period.
Yes,
is
I would.
Is there any other evidence of how much was paid in dividends from the time of death until the hearing on the surcharge?
I do not recall any, and if there was some, it would not have been offered by us, because our position is that the dividends would have been much lower than what the stock value should have been had it been diversified. And that's our position is.
But the question here is, what duty did a reasonable personal representative have to sell the stock? And so that's what bothers me, is because hindsight's always 20/20. If he would have sold it early and it had rebounded and gone back up, he would have been subject to criticism for that. Also in this case, I think it is relevant that even though the stock price was declining, the dividends were still fairly substantial. I saw a figure $39,000 in dividends for some period of time. So how can that be ignored?
I think hindsight 2020. That's a fair phrase, but it's not fair within the context of this case, where Richard was a personal representative for over a year, and there was essentially nothing being done. We didn't have, so he's not doing anything with the stocks. The rent is not being collected, despite multiple requests from my client, Christine Spaniards, in various forms, which Richard admitted during the first trial that he ignored.
What evidence? Here's the other thing. You did not call an expert on the issue of the stock, did you?
No, we did not.
So what is the standard? What evidence did you put on to carry your burden to say that this PR failed to act reasonably because he didn't sell the stock?
We had testimony from my client, as well as the document evidence of the history of the closing amounts of the stock in the S&P 500.
And is your client a financial expert?
She is not, Your Honor.
So again, I come back. Hindsight's 20/20. It's a, you know, darned if you do, darned if you don't type thing. So where's the violation of his obligation to act as a reasonable person would act in the same or similar situation?
It's based in the statute. He always has that duty to do what a prudent investor would do. And I think just taking into account the amount of time that he didn't make any change, despite the fact that it's undisputed, the stock was cut in value by at least half by the time of his removal.
But still paying dividends.
And yeah.
What's your response to Mr. Whitmore's argument that the probate statutes prevented him from selling the stock?
I disagree with that. And this is covered at length in our brief as well. But to summarize, it's a statute that's based on if you have an estate with a will. We don't have a will. This is an intestate estate. So he had no obligation to hold it or distribute it in kind. And the other point I do want to emphasize is the our position is the first order from March of 2022 is that was a final order that if he wanted to appeal from that, he had to do that within 30 days. This falls under a special proceeding. There's no dispute about that under the case law, and it affected a substantial right. There's case law that orders removing a trustee, for example, that affected a substantial right, and that had to be appealed within 30 days. So I think we're dealing with a procedural posture of you did things wrong, you were removed, you can't try to challenge that at this point in time. And we had evidence that there was dissipation of assets, and his actions underlying the dissipation of assets was not in the best interests of the estate.
So Ms. Ryan, you agreed with us that it's difficult to determine how the court arrived at its damage figure. What do we do with that? What's your suggestion?
What you can do is you can still uphold the surcharge order because we have very discretionary standards of review, and it's within the limits of the maximum amount that would have been allowed by the evidence that we offered and was admitted. So with that, I would ask that this court affirm the orders of surcharge as well as attorney's fees for my client in denying attorney fees for Richard.
Thank you,
Ms. Ryan.
Thank you.
There are no other questions. And thank you also, Mr. Whitmore, for being here and arguing your case today. We will take the case under submission, and you are all excused. Thank you.